Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie. And before I start the actual episode, I'd just like to let you know that for any couples who are in the earlier stages of recovery that are looking for some kind of healing work to do together, Helping Couples Heal is about to launch our Bridge to Connection group, which is going to be a 4-week transformative group to help couples navigate the early stages, including safety and stabilization, and helping to create a roadmap for what's ahead. And it's also a great opportunity to connect with others who are on the same path. Please email our support team for more information at support@helpingcouplesheal.com. The group starts mid-August, which is right around the corner. So if you're interested, please get in touch with us as soon as possible. All right, I'm going to start the episode now. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Helping Couples Heal podcast, a place for healing and hope for couples impacted by betrayal resulting from infidelity and or sex addiction. Your host is Marnie Breaker, licensed marriage and family therapist, certified sex addiction therapist, and founder of the Center for Relational Healing in Los Angeles and San Diego, California. The Helping Couples Heal podcast was launched in 2021 with the intention of bringing hope to couples all over the world who are desperately trying to recover from the devastating impact of betrayal. Realizing how many people the podcast was reaching and that we could offer even more support to our listeners, Marnie co-founded Helping Couples Heal, which has since grown into a global online coaching organization. This podcast is the foundation of all the work that we do at Helping Couples Heal. Thank you for listening. Marnie brings over a decade of experience and expertise in the field of betrayal trauma and is honored to support you wherever you may be in your healing. If you've lost hope, you've come to the right place. Now, take a slow, deep breath and let's begin with the Helping Couples Heal podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie. And today I have a guest who is going to be sharing her story of compulsive pornography use as part of a larger sex addiction. You know, so often, not just on this podcast, but really in the recovery world, we hear a lot of stories from men about their experience with pornography use. And we don't really hear from women. And that is not because women are not suffering with pornography use and sex addiction, but there really are stigmas associated with it for women. And so I'm really honored and grateful that we have somebody who has been willing and open to come on the podcast and share about her experience. And so I am really happy to introduce you to Jess, and we're just going to jump on in. So welcome, Jess. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
All right. Well, there's a lot to talk about and unpack. I think perhaps we can just start with a short introduction from you about your addiction. You can share as much or as little as you'd like, but just to give people an understanding of why you are here and talking about this topic and how it has had an impact on you and your life.
Yeah. How to sum up a life story in a few minutes? Well, I think it's good to contextualize. I'm 31, almost 32. So I'm a true millennial. And I have been in recovery rooms around this stuff since November of 2017. The addiction takes many different forms for different people. And what really brought me to the surrender point was some really toxic relationships. And then in my healing from those ending, there's just a lot of acting out and promiscuity. And that had all sort of been the bottom of a very long journey in my childhood, really, and adolescence. And it did start with pornography. It started with pornography at a very young age. And I think that sort of got the ball rolling and really turned up the intensity from a very young age. So yeah, I've been in recovery for that time. And I'm always really grateful to speak. I've never spoken on this level, but, you know, I'm grateful to speak to other people in recovery and say that I have a history with porn use and that it really hurt me. And I think it really sort of constructed the way my addiction manifested.
Well, first, I want to say that I think it's incredibly brave and gracious of you to come on, because I know that you're here because you understand the suffering that comes from addiction, and you are wanting to offer hope and support to other people out there who are suffering. So thank you. I'm thanking you on behalf of our listeners. And yeah, it's very courageous. And I really respect all the hard work that you've done, because, you know, in hearing your story, it's clear that, like you said, this has been a long journey and you have really put in the work. And putting in the work is not just going to meetings and not just stopping the behavior, but it's diving deep and looking underneath at the myriad of reasons why addiction can become a part of your life. So thank you. And I'm wondering if you can maybe share then a little bit about your history of pornography use and the progression that it had in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, I'm 31. I'm like the first generation, I would say, of kids who sort of grew up straddling. I had an early childhood without technology and without computers and the internet. And then I remember getting my computer in fifth grade and a cell phone around the same time. And while they were very different than they are now, they still worked. And I'll also say, I think my first intro into pornography was my mom had access to a channel back in the day of DirecTV. It was like a subscription channel of a pretty hardcore porn channel. And, you know, I think for whatever reason, single mom, I was creative and had access and I could find these things. I also was exposed to some pretty like sexualized content as a young person. I remember my family listening to Howard Stern in front of me often back when it was bleeped out. And I think they thought I was young and didn't understand, but kids understand.
Kids understand way more than we think they do. So do you remember how it felt for you inside? Like, was it uncomfortable or was it exciting or confusing?
I think it was confusing. Somehow I made the connection that this is bad. I knew it was like what the adults did and that I shouldn't really get it. Yet there I was. It's almost like how when you have a kid and you spell things in front of them because they don't know how to spell yet. That's kind of what it felt like. But the reality was, is I knew how to spell.
Nobody was pulling anything over on you.
Yeah, something was happening. I don't know why people go towards what addiction they go towards, but this was something that worked. This was something that really captivated me and got my attention. And it was a really good distraction. Good in that it was effective. I had a lot of stuff going on at home when I was little and a lot of loss and trauma and grief and divorce and et cetera, et cetera. And this was a really effective way to help with a lot of anxiety, I think. I was a very anxious kid. I was very scared of things happening. And when I was with pornography, I wasn't scared. I was soothed and I was not in reality.
So that's what you meant when you said it worked, because it distracted you.
That's what I meant when I said it worked. And I didn't have a memory of this, but I was told recently by a family friend that there was a time when I was, I think, around 8 years old, and I had locked myself in a room with porn, and my mom was aware that I was watching it, and she was trying to get the door open, and I wouldn't unlock the door. But eventually when I did, I was hysterical crying. And first of all, I had no memory of that. And this family friend is a very credible person. So I definitely trust that story, and the fact that I didn't have a memory of it and that I blocked that out is really interesting. I also think the fact that I was hysterical crying really tells that there was either an element of shame or disgust or fright.
Yeah, that's a really powerful story. And the crying, yeah, that really stands out to me. It says that you were impacted in some very profound way, and we don't know exactly what that way was, but it certainly, it sounds like, set the stage for more compulsive pornography use as you got older. So can you share a little bit about the progression for you?
Sure. I think getting a computer was a really big deal. Like I said, about 2001, 2002, with pirating off the internet, and back when there was all these ways to pirate files. I don't even know what they're called anymore. It's so different now. But somehow I knew what to look for. I mean, I don't really exactly know what it looks like in 2024. But I will say that then it kind of felt a little bit more like the Wild Wild West, in that you just kind of would get what you got, and who knows what you got, you know? And so I remember being exposed to some really graphic things. And then I think as I got older being like maybe high school, middle school, violent content. I mean, maybe nobody was getting like physically assaulted, but the types of content that was being viewed was a real, there was a violence there. There was a tone of violence. There was a tone of very much a power dynamic, very much, I think, hurting women. And I don't really remember being conscious of that.
And Jess, did you tell people about your pornography use? Did you talk to friends or
no?
Nobody at all?
No, I think it was normal for boys to like talk about it amongst each other, but I never would admit to it. That would have been way too weird, not feminine.
Right. It's not something that women do.
It's not something that women do. And I will say that some of my acting out too began on the internet with chat rooms and those kinds of things when I was very young. And I think I could tell those people, or it helped me sort of, I can't even imagine like what I sounded like, but like I thought that perhaps I had known a thing or two, because actually I was exposed to this stuff and I knew stuff that I don't think any child should know, or maybe any person should know realistically.
That sounds like you are acknowledging that what you saw really harmed you in some way.
Absolutely. And the progression came by, I would definitely stay home from school sometimes and just watch all day. It felt very secretive. It felt like a ritual. It was like a secret world. It was my own secret sort of sexual basement in my childhood home, actually.
Wow. And so did you have the experience of the compulsive porn use impacting your mood? Did you feel like your parents were aware that something was going on? How did this impact you in your daily life?
In my head at the time, I did not think they knew. It felt even more sort of exciting, or it upped the intensity for them to not know, or to maybe almost get caught or something, but them never knowing. However, with the story that I shared earlier about being locked in the room, that does indicate that my parent did know at one point. So that sort of shatters that reality. You know, trauma is an interesting thing, how it affects people and it affects memory. And I think there's definitely a factor of forgetting that happens. Who knows why? Well, you maybe know why, but...
I don't know everything by any means. So what happened for you, Jess, that it stopped working and that you wanted to seek help? Because I really heard you when you said that, you know, girls don't do this. And so there's sort of this shroud of secrecy and not telling people. And you also said to me earlier, before we started to record, that you weren't honest about your porn use with partners because it felt very much like it was okay and normal for men to use pornography, but it wasn't okay. And you even said that it was weird to use porn. So how did you get to a place where you sought help?
Well, I think when I came to get help, it wasn't really framed around porn. You know, I don't even think that there would have necessarily been a way in the way that I know for men, many men come into recovery very, very at a bottom with porn, you know? I don't even feel like there was a space, or is kind of a space today, for that to happen. My disease or my addiction just manifested in other ways that became much more unmanageable. I guess I just didn't even have the capacity to really be honest about my porn use, even in early recovery.
I will say that generally speaking, when a man has an addiction, oftentimes they do come in. I can say this as a therapist in my own experience. They'll come in and they'll tell me right off the bat that they're struggling with pornography or that they got caught with pornography and, you know, their partner was devastated by it. It was a whole secret life, done in secret, very deceptive. And they'll literally come in and tell me that. What I have seen with the female clients that I've worked with over the years who identify as sex and or love addicts, they come in and they don't say, I'm a sex and love addict, or I'm a love addict, or I'm a sex addict. They come in with something else presenting, like depression or anxiety or interpersonal issues, or, you know, continuing to end up in toxic relationships, trauma, things like that. And it often then gets uncovered. So I think that's really an interesting dynamic right there around like gender pathology.
Absolutely. I feel like there's much more space for men in recovery to come right out and say it and to be honest about how they're suffering with porn and masturbation or compulsive sex, and where it's women have to sort of sneak their way into the recovery rooms and it has to look a certain way in order to be gendered appropriately and like the appropriate gender expression of this horrible thing that doesn't actually care about your gender or your class or any race, any of it.
Right, absolutely. So how did you get into the rooms? What actually led you there? You were saying a few minutes ago that you didn't have necessarily like a bottom the way a lot of the men who ended up in the recovery rooms did. So what was the experience that you had?
Well, the first time I had heard about the recovery rooms was from a therapist, and I believe he kind of just heard a pattern coming out, and he directed me in the direction of the rooms. This was actually in 2014, and I just wasn't ready. This is more of a relational dynamic, getting involved with very unavailable people, myself having some history of infidelity in past relationships, just really being in sort of that love addict, love avoidant cycle. And at the time, I was in a love addict, love avoidant cycle with somebody. And so I just wasn't able to stop that relationship. And I just didn't stay in the rooms. But what happened was, this is for another episode, but that relationship led me into a cult. I followed that person into a cult because, again, addiction doesn't care about you. And you'll hear a lot of times you'll go to any lengths for your addiction. And so I was told in pretty much very direct terms that if I wanted to be with that partner that I was very love addicted to, I would have to be in this group. And so I did exactly that. And just to make a long story short, when that relationship ended, I kind of had a realization, what the heck just happened here? I'm in a cult. Then I had to go through a process of that. Again, another episode. And from there, I was in such deep pain from that relationship ending that it just led me. This was the year of 2017. As soon as I mustered up enough strength and was in enough sort of numbness, I started really using substances a lot more in the daytime. But as soon as I kind of went through a first section of withdrawal from that, I went to sexual acting out, and I had a series of just promiscuity, and it just led me to a place where I was like, I am really sick and this is not working anymore. And I remembered going to the rooms and where to go. And so I sought out a therapist who specialized in this stuff. And through her help, I joined the program in 2017, and I've stayed.
And what was it like for you to first go in there, especially, you know, again, coming back to this idea that there weren't as many women and it was more stigmatized and you hadn't really shared? So what was it like for you to open up about this?
Oh, I was petrified. I would have panic attacks before going to meetings. I was at the time still abusing drugs and alcohol, and I would take pills like benzodiazepine that was not prescribed to me in order to go sit in a meeting because it was so overwhelming for me. I could barely talk. My heart would beat out of my chest. I was a raw nerve, and it took a long time for that to sort of calm down. And yes, at the time there was much less women than there are now. I would say now there's more of like a love addiction sort of place where there is more women. There's a lot of younger people actually post-pandemic. I've really noticed there's a big, like almost like a renaissance explosion of a lot of younger people coming to terms that they have some big issues around relationships, sex, intimacy. So yeah, it was really scary to come to terms with all that. My withdrawal was very intense. I really cut everything off. I did a no contact from men for a very long time, like no conversations, no touching, no, it was like what we call light and polite. It was like 3-minute conversations about, you know, the weather and gotta go. And that lasted a long time. I kind of got into a chrysalis where I really had to melt and become a new person. And that took, I would say, about 2 years to come out of that. And then since then, I've done the steps and I've done, been of service to other people and I've done sober dating and my life looks a hell of a lot different today. But yeah, I mean, what was it like? Everything in my life changed 100%. I became a new human being.
So as you look back on your porn use, what do you think was the most damaging to you? How do you feel that it was harmful? I hear you sort of hit your own bottom. You know, you were being promiscuous, all of this, and you ended up in the rooms. But how did you know you needed to go? Like some people are promiscuous and they're okay with it, right? They don't end up in a program and they feel okay. They're making consensual choices and they're all right. You didn't feel that way. You felt like you needed help. So how was it harmful?
I just had a sense from a very young age, probably from the time I was exposed to porn, that something was very different with me. Something was wrong in this area. Other people kind of had the rule book and they could kind of figure out how to do it. And I could not figure it out. I was always chasing. I wasn't even conscious of the available people who were interested in me. I could not even see them at all. I was so focused on just confirming my own unworthiness, just a lot of trauma. And I think the porn, the way it shaped me was it just sexualized me from such a young age. I thought sex was something very different than what it is and what healthy sex is, you know, and what I've learned it to be. I thought it was a performance. I was very disassociated. I was very self-conscious. I was constantly, it almost felt like if I was having a sexual experience, I was there, but I was looking at myself about how's this doing and does it look like what these other women are doing and how their bodies look and how they're expressing and all of that.
So it wasn't about an experience of pleasure and connection.
No, there was very disassociated physically, a lot of numbness. And it was not about an emotional connection. I just didn't even know how to get there with somebody at all. Way too scary, way too intense. But what was being acted out was ironically so much more physically. The word that's coming to mind is just like not kind, not gentle, just very harsh. Yeah, I have a lot of sadness around that.
When you think about that girl, who you were at that time, what would you want to say to her?
Just, I love you and I'm sorry and you didn't deserve this. After the work that I've done, one, I will say the hope is that recovery gave me a chance to have sort of the innocence and the sweetness of real intimacy and kindness and loving and getting to know somebody in a safe way and real connection. Real caring about one another, real authenticity, real vulnerability, intimacy, real intimacy. So the miracle is that I got that and I got to sort of have a reparative experience. And also to that young girl, I don't think she stood a chance. I think anybody who is exposed to that and anybody with wiring similar to mine would have a very similar reaction. And I'm grateful for the porn addiction. I'm grateful for the sex and love addiction because the reality is there was a lot of stuff happening in my life at home during that time that was so painful that who knows, that could have kept me alive. You know, it was effective until it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about addiction is that it often does save our life. That's one of the reasons, or probably the primary reason that people end up with addiction. It's to avoid the pain and to not have to look deep. And when somebody gets sober from the behavior, there's nowhere else to go except into reality, into the truth, into the pain, and to dig deep and to feel the grief. And that's really hard. And that's why I always say it's so courageous for people to get into recovery and to do the work. I mean, it's so painful. The outcomes, when they're positive outcomes, yield amazing joy and connection. And like you said, real intimacy also, like separate from having, like you said, this wiring where your wiring is different from quote unquote, like a normie. Also, as children and then young adults, we're not taught about healthy intimacy or healthy sexuality. So when you've got somebody who's had trauma and family issues, difficulty at home, and faulty wiring, let's say, or predisposition to addiction, and then having had no role models of healthy intimacy, I mean, that's sort of like the recipe for disaster in this area.
Yeah. And the reality is that I was swimming in a fishbowl where there were plenty of other fish that had been swimming in that same water. There was plenty of other people who were just as willing to be in that sort of unhealthy, over-sexualized porn, seeing through that lens, being raised through that lens of hypersexuality or unhealthy, whatever. There was plenty of other people. I wasn't alone.
When I asked you that question a few minutes ago about how did this harm you, one of the things I'm really hearing is that you sexualized yourself as a result of watching pornography and you saw other women being exploited and sexualized. And then it sounds like you did that to yourself. Is that how you experienced
Absolutely.
it?
I looked at myself as an object and I truly just equated my value with if I could get some sort of sexual validation or how I could perform, or it was a very shallow, empty, the void was so big because that was the version of myself that I knew. And I will say, I forgot this part. So I got into the recovery on November 7th. On October 30th is my birthday. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror after being drunk and high and acting out. And I had a moment of clarity. I kind of was struck sober in that moment. And I saw myself and I was young. I was 25 and I looked beautiful. It was Halloween time. So I was in this outfit at a party. And I just looked at myself in the eyes and I had this moment where I was like, there was a voice that was like, where are you? This is not working. Even though all the outside is this, I don't know where you went.
I feel really sad hearing that. Sad hearing that, but looking at you now, so our audience members don't see you, but I have the pleasure of being able to see you because we are looking at each other over Zoom. And who I see sitting in front of me is a really confident woman who looks joyful and happy. So I'm curious, Jess, if you can share, when you look at yourself today, what do you see?
The amazing thing about recovery and doing the work is that my insides match my outsides. And I live in alignment with who I want to be. I'm pointed in the direction of who I want to be. I know I'm the woman that I want to be. I like the woman I'm becoming. I always had a sense that I wasn't going to figure it out. Like I couldn't figure this out. And now I'm just like, I'm walking in the path and I see how I'm able to show up for other people. I see how I'm uniquely gifted to help other people who have this path, who deal with these struggles. And I see how incredibly strong I am. I see how incredibly gracefully I've managed to have this recovery. And you know, life is in session and stuff happens and I've had sober relationships and sober breakups and it hasn't been perfect. What I say is I feel like I was plucked off of one timeline and just put on a completely different plane of existence where, you know, I'm not in a relationship right now, but God willing, I'll have another relationship. And if my last relationship was like the best relationship I've ever had, it was in a whole other league. Like we're not even speaking the same language. We're not even playing the same. It's like, it's a completely new experience.
It was so much better than what you had before.
It's a completely new experience of living and of being. So yeah, I love my life today. It's really calm. I love the work that I do. Sobriety has been the best thing to ever happen to me. Yeah.
Wow. What do you think your life would have been like if you didn't find sobriety?
I don't know if I would be alive. Like, if I was alive, I'd be so spiritually dead and exhausted. I mean, just the exhaustion of keeping up with the addiction. Like I said, I was 25, and so I was spent. I was exhausted, and I know people go on for many more decades, you know? So I don't know. I don't know what it would have looked like. I feel like there would have been a lot more chasing, a lot more aspiring and trying, and just in this sort of like performative world instead of just really being and owning and loving the life that I have today and making choices based off of, like I said, my insides matching my outsides, making choices based off of my own integrity and my own inner compass that I really got to find, because it's in there.
Yeah, it is. Your story is so inspiring. I'm hoping that people that are listening that might be able to relate, and not just women, you know, men too, because at the end of the day, addiction is addiction and suffering is suffering. And you know, I'm hoping that people can hear how much your life has changed. And I've heard you say that you're grateful for this experience because it allowed you to get to where you are today. I guess my last question for you is, what do you think about pornography now after all of this?
It makes me so incredibly sad and scared for children. You know, I know how much more integrated we are with technology. I think it really needs to be addressed. I think people need to have conversations about it because it absolutely is happening. I'll say I didn't stop watching pornography until several years into my recovery, believe it or not. It wasn't a compulsive thing at the time. Like I said, I think with women, it's like there's just a way we can sort of avoid talking about it. And I just had this sense at a certain point where I was like, this has been something that wired my brain in a certain way. And I really want to know what it's like to live without that interference. And I'll just say, like, I had an experience recently where my phone broke and I had to get a new phone. And I just pulled out an old phone, one of my old phones from years ago. And I turned it on. I opened the browser and there was still something up. There was a pornographic image, and the reaction that I had to it, I was like, oh my goodness, like, this feels like such a violation. And to know that that was just in my life, you know, just makes me feel grateful for the time that I've had away from it. I think it's really allowed me to have deeper connections with people, with friends, with myself. It's also really helped me to humanize men, believe it or not. As I begin to objectify myself less, it allows me to see others as people too, as real human beings, and not somebody who's trying to consume me or that I have to be a commodity for. So just deeper levels of healing. I was just saying earlier before we recorded, I don't know of an ethical way to consume porn. I haven't heard of it yet. I know there's a lot of people trying to find a way, but I am just in the camp that, first of all, there's never been a time where human beings have been exposed to this kind of content as much as it is at the rate, you know, maybe 100 years ago you saw a few, like, who knows, some drawings or something, and now it's on a whole nother level. So I just think for the sake of preserving our brains, preserving our hearts, preserving our connection, there's just such a gift of not having that toxicity.
It's sad because you're right. We've never been exposed on this level. It's so accessible. It's affordable and it's anonymous, right? People can do this in the privacy of their own homes. You don't have to go into an adult bookstore anymore and go into the back room and buy DVDs, right? Or at one point VHS tapes or whatever that is, and look at the salesperson in the eye. And, you know, people knew what you were doing and they knew what you were watching. And now that's not how it is. And you could look at all that stuff and then walk out and go to your office and be quite functional and yet have this secret life, and you're filled with shame and your actions are incongruent with your own values and you're hiding from your partner. And, you know, living like that is exhausting and it is crazy making. And it's really wonderful to see an example of somebody who has proven you don't have to live like that and that you can get out of that.
You can. It is hard. It's not easy, but I'm telling you, if you hear anything today, the pain, the addiction, and that negative goal, that is, it is pain for pain's sake. It's not productive. The pain of recovery, it's a healing pain. It's a beautiful pain. It's a pain.
Yeah.
But it is a worthwhile, deep thing that gets to get integrated. It gets to become who you are. And yes, the number one gift I've given myself for sure. And yes, there is a life available. I know a lot of young people who are very against pornography use because, you know, our generation and younger generations, and I know it affects everybody, but I think because we are exposed at such a young age, it's such a huge rate.
Well, younger people are learning about sex through pornography. That's what they're seeing. So they see the way bodies are quote unquote supposed to look. They're seeing the way people are supposed to react to being touched in a certain way or certain acts. And those are not real reactions. Like you said, it's all performative and exploitive. And we're learning that to think that people like things that really in real life, these people don't like at all. And this is not healthy sex education.
No. It's dehumanizing and it's such a disservice and it literally takes away our humanity. It takes away the beauty of who we are and the levels that we can connect at and just all of this richness that is not available in pornography and the kind of sex it advocates for.
Yeah, I mean, you know that I have a six-year-old little boy and I'm so crazy about him and I so want him to have healthy self-esteem. And I want him to value other people and to not sexualize other people and to not objectify. And to be honest, I'm scared because I could protect him in my own home. I think, you know, with what I know and what I've learned, I feel like I have some ways of protecting him, but that's going to change as he gets older. I don't know what he's going to be exposed to. All I can do is educate him the best I can and hope for the best. Yeah, it's scary. It's a scary world out there. And I do want to let people know that there is help, there is hope, there's support. And, you know, especially for suffering in silence, because like just talked about, it can be very isolating. There could be a lot of shame, a lot of fear of talking about it. But there are a lot of resources and there are a lot of people who will understand and who will listen. And actually, Jess has offered for anybody who feels like they would like to hear more of her story or get some support. She is open to talking. So if anybody would like to reach out to her, you can send a message to support@helpingcouplesheal.com and we will get those messages forwarded over to her. So Jess, I just want to say thank you. I've said it several times, but really, you have represented a very underrepresented population by being here today. And I hope that people that listen will forward this along to other people who might really need it. And those people can forward it to other people. And we can get the word out that there is life after pornography and there's a good life after porn.
A beautiful life, a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm seeing so many others live it too. So just know that you don't have to do this alone. There are other people who have been through this and just there's hope. There's hope.
That's a really great way to end because this whole podcast from, in fact, I think the first episode we ever did might've been called Hope. And so what a wonderful way to wrap this up because the whole podcast was founded on the principles of providing hope to people and reminding people that we can be in the depths of despair and the depths of grief and pain and trauma and loss and all of that. And yet there's hope. And I think that when we're in that darkness, it's really hard to believe that something else is possible.
I'll super quickly just say, like, if you would have told me 10 years ago that you're going to be talking in a podcast about your pornography use and you're all, I would have ran for the hills and been mortified. And like the fact that I can look at you and say this stuff and be willing. And it's because it's part of my story. It is not who I am.
No, you're such a beautiful, courageous person. And, you know, I feel honored to know you. I feel honored to be able to hear your story and to share it with others. And I love that you're able to look me in the eyes and share your story and to feel received and to know that, well, your story is safe with me. Now it is out there for, hundreds of thousands of people to hear. But I think that those people who listen to this podcast are ones that will hold it close to their hearts and keep it safe.
Yeah. And the whole thing is I don't have to live in secrets today.
No.
I don't have to live in a secret.
Thanks, Jess. It was really awesome to have this conversation with you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Helping Couples Heal podcast, where your healing is our number one priority. If you'd like additional resources about betrayal trauma or to learn more about our coaching services, please visit helpingcouplesheal.com or call 562-379-4325. Our help is available worldwide. Please support Helping Couples Heal in continuing to reach others impacted by betrayal trauma by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast with someone you care about. For additional support, follow us on Instagram and consider joining our Helping Couples Heal private Facebook community. This isn't an easy journey, but you don't have to do it alone. Once again, thank you for listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie. And before I start the actual episode, I'd just like to let you know that for any couples who are in the earlier stages of recovery that are looking for some kind of healing work to do together, Helping Couples Heal is about to launch our Bridge to Connection group, which is going to be a 4-week transformative group to help couples navigate the early stages, including safety and stabilization, and helping to create a roadmap for what's ahead. And it's also a great opportunity to connect with others who are on the same path. Please email our support team for more information at support@helpingcouplesheal.com. The group starts mid-August, which is right around the corner. So if you're interested, please get in touch with us as soon as possible. All right, I'm going to start the episode now. I hope you enjoy.